welcome to this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and all the surrounding villages and communities. My name is Rob Pearman, and this programme is for the week beginning Saturday the 14th of May 2022. That's the opening to a piece of music called The Robin. As usual with the titles of some of Goffby's great pieces, I don't know why it's called that. But anyway, it's quite fun. I hope you enjoy it. Welcome to you, of course, and especially if you're a new listener. We have a few more joining us this week from St Albans. Now, a bit of information and to some extent a reminder for you that the AGM, the Annual General Meeting of the local Talking Newspaper, is held each April. And for the last many years, we've been holding this meeting at the church and the church hall of St Mary's in Marshalswick. It's a short business meeting and then an afternoon tea. We haven't been there since 2019 because of COVID. And this year, we are still COVID cautious. So on the 23rd of April, we held the business part of our AGM online using Zoom for those who could access it and on telephone lines for those who preferred that. We just dealt with the business bits. That was the accounts. We needed approval of the accounts so that we can send those off to the Charity Commissioner. And we needed to have the reports. And listeners received those reports in an audio form prior to the AGM. And all the volunteers received them in some written form that they could access. We are assuming that by the late summer, it will be safe to bring listeners and volunteers together for a special afternoon tea inside a building. No luxury is going to be spared at St Michael's Manor Hotel in Fishbowl Street in St Albans. And we have a special guest, Gail Stewart, the long-suffering daughter of the late Eric Morecambe. Now, I say long-suffering because he must have been quite tough to live with, cracking jokes all the time. Anyway, Gail will tell us some of these tales when we see her on August the 23rd in the afternoon, final times yet to be arranged. But that's August the 23rd, it's a Tuesday. And we're in the afternoon, and we will have volunteer drivers to pick up those who need a lift to the event and home again afterwards. So this is at St Michael's Manor in Fishbowl Street. More details as we go. Now, back to today. First, as usual, local news from the Hearts Advertiser, plus a few others from local news websites. After that, we'll take a break with a bit more of our theme music, The Robin. And then after this brief interlude, a dip into the past. Last month, I played you a discussion of a novel by Daphne du Maurier. It's available as an audiobook from Caliber Audio, which we borrowed and were able to take some extracts from. And it's also, I'm sure, in the RNIB library as well. It's called The Scapegoat and was something different from this author. It was not set in Cornwall like Rebecca and Jamaica Inn and various other novels by Daphne du Maurier. This one, The Scapegoat, was set in France. Anyway, that's what we read last time. I think I said last time as well that several of us are currently preparing a new series of talking book discussions. A number of people, including me, are currently reading and listening to books by the following authors: Thomas Hardy, John Le Carré, Beryl Bainbridge, Laura Cumming, a new author to me, Andrea Levy, Bernardine Evaristo, of course, the winner of the Booker Prize in, I can't remember which year, but it wasn't very long ago, and the great Zadie Smith, also John Steinbeck. Now, the first of these is a look at Thomas Hardy's famous novel, Far From the Madding Crowd, and this will be ready for us next month. So this week, I'm going right back to the beginning of this long series of discussions about audiobooks. This is from 2014, and I'm chatting with one of the Hertfordshire Library team with whom we began this whole series. And we're looking at four titles: Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, A Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian, An Utterly Impartial History of Britain, or 2,000 Years of Upper-Class Idiots in Charge by John Farrell. We were discussing it in 2014, so it's long before the present government were in place. And finally, we were looking at The Instructions for a Heatwave by Maggie O'Farrell. Now, ironically, John O'Farrell and Maggie O'Farrell, two authors, but they're not related. I'd have to say this is the first book by Maggie O'Farrell that I'd come across, and I have read a number of hers since and listened to the audiobooks as well. Then we move on to the radio listings. That's to say a selection of programmes on the radio that you might be interested in listening to this coming week. Now, after that, it's the return of some exercise. Those of you who were with us prior to the last couple of months will remember that we had a series of 10 exercise classes, and we went through those every 2 weeks. Well, the second series is now with us, and I'll be offering you the first in the second series. There are 10 of them, and they're approximately 10 minutes long. Then our final item is a description of some of the events that took place in this very week at some time in the past, some ancient history, some more recent. And then a few of the famous people whose birthdays were in this very week. Finally, we'll close with our musical theme in full.
Right, so let's get on with this week's show, which means moving on now to the news stories, all of which are from the Hearts Advertiser, plus a few from the Hearts Advertiser's online news site, or from the Hertfordshire Heritage Archive. And this week's newsreaders are Claire, Catherine, another Claire, Mayo, Margaret and John. And first up is Claire.
And after the astonishing results in the local elections, the front page story could not be about anything else. And the headline says it all. Lib Dems annihilate Tories in unprecedented council election triumph. Accountability and humility will be at the heart of the district council's new administration after the Lib Dems wiped out Tory opposition in a savage political bloodbath. The vote in last week's elections saw a staggering 50 Liberal Democrat councillors elected out of a total of 56, leaving the Conservatives with just 4 members, plus 1 Green and 1 Independent, one of the most remarkable results in the country. Speaking exclusively to the Hearts Advertiser, triumphant leader Chris White said he would honour the sacred trust between his party and the electorate. The results of the district council elections, as always with such elections, reflected a number of factors. There was clear support on the doorsteps for what we were doing at the council and a rejection of the alternatives. There were also astonishing levels of anger with the Conservatives at a national level, as well as huge support for St Albans MP Daisy Cooper, even outside her own constituency. The Lib Dem group is now larger than it has ever been, and this immediately calls for humility. Many did not vote for us, and we will not overlook them. There are also massive challenges ahead of us, not least the inflation levels, which will provide yet more challenges to local government finances. We will be looking to set up new ways of being accountable to the voters. We believe that politics in the district can now be more constructive and civilised with the departure of some of the key players and the rejection of Trump-style politics. It's a sacred trust. We will live up to it and get on with tackling the climate emergency, the shortage of social housing and improving the services and facilities the council provides to the community. Among the casualties of the election were Tory leader Mary Maynard and long-term councillors Richard Curtoys, Berwick Reid, Julian Daly, Stella Nash, Francis Leonard and Jill Clark. We'll come back to the election in more detail later, but first, some other news stories.
Hello everyone, Catherine here. Cathedral is illuminated in blue to shine a light on mental health. St Albans Cathedral is being illuminated turquoise to mark this year's Mental Health Awareness Week. The initiative is also to show support for local mental health awareness charity It's OK to Say, which uses this colour to encourage people to take a walk around the cathedral and consider their own mental health and whether they need any support. It's OK to Say prides itself in helping remove stigmas by actively encouraging people to talk openly about mental health on a day-to-day basis and through various campaigns and projects. Canon Chancellor at the Cathedral, the Reverend Dr. Kevin Walton, said, "The Cathedral is delighted to show its support for the charity It's OK to Say by lighting our building in blue. There are times when any of us might be carrying within us a burden which is unseen or unspoken, so it is good to bring to light the reality of mental health." Charity founder Stacey Turner said, "For the last 3 years, the cathedral has illuminated in the charity's colour to offer comfort and remind people to consider their own mental health. It's a time of reflection and, of course, to encourage people to reach out for support. We hope people will embrace this week and be reminded of how important and precious they are, even when they don't feel like it. Us humans can be fragile, with emotional hurt and pain invisible, often going unnoticed. Even if you have never considered yourself to need the help of a professional, we also offer casual coffee chat sessions where you can come in, have a cuppa, and enjoy the comfort of the office. Now more than ever, and in particular due to the short-term and long-term effects of COVID, many people require support after being impacted by both illness, lockdowns, and restrictions. There is still a sense of hopelessness, a loss of confidence, and in some cases grief over what has been lost by many in our community. This year's theme of loneliness is so fitting, as it provides an opportunity to try and encourage connection in order to support this.
Hello, this is Claire reading today. My first article is called Youth Talk Faces Biggest Demand for Services in Its History, and it's by Laura Bill. A St Albans charity offering mental health support for youngsters aged 13 to 25 is facing the biggest demand in its 25-year history. Youth Talk has revealed it is desperately seeking additional financial support to meet growing requests for help as we mark this year's Mental Health Awareness Week, which is May 9th to the 15th. Before the pandemic, the charity was already seeing an increase in the number of young people struggling with their emotional well-being and mental health. But since COVID, requests for help have soared. Youth Talk is currently providing around 100 counselling sessions per week and supports over 400 young people per year. Over the last year, the charity has delivered 32% more counselling sessions, but the demand continues to rise. Chief Executive David Barker said, "It's a worrying time. Never in our 25-year history have we seen such a huge demand on our service. There are over 100 young people currently on our waiting list, and when a young person is brave enough to take that first step towards getting help, they shouldn't be kept waiting. We want to help, but currently don't have the resources to support everyone at the point they reach out to us. We and our community have a duty to every young person in our district to provide them with the support they need during this challenging time." He added, "There is an urgent need to scale up what we do. We have a new 5-year strategy where we want to double our counselling provision, and as part of this need larger premises so we can undertake more face-to-face counselling. Currently, around 60% of our sessions are held face-to-face. We are incredibly thankful to our local individual and corporate sponsors who we rely on for funding, but we need more money and support to realise our vital ambition to support the growing numbers of local young people needing help. Donors, future volunteers, or those needing support can gain further information by visiting youthtalk.org.uk. Mental Health Awareness Week is an opportunity for the whole UK to focus on achieving good mental health. The theme this year is loneliness, which has had a huge impact on physical and mental health during the pandemic."
And staying with that charity, here is news of another major donation by a local business. A partnership between a St Albans solicitors and a local mental health charity has seen more than £10,000 raised to help provide vital counselling for young people. Debenhams Otterway celebrated the end of its partnership with Youth Talk by making a donation to fund 200 much-needed sessions. This collaborative partnership started back in 2018, and in the last 4 years, Debenhams Otterway staff have held various fundraising events supported by matched funding and donations from the firm. From bake sales to photo competitions, bingo nights and triathlons, their team got involved in a wide range of fundraising activities, extending their support beyond fundraising, from providing pro bono legal advice to offering their meeting space. David Barker, Chief Executive at Youth Talk, said they had been truly blessed by the backing of Debenhams Otterway.
The Conservatives were annihilated in previously safe seats in Harpenden and Redbourne in the local council elections, which saw an unprecedented Liberal Democrat landslide across the district. Tory leader Mary Maynard and party mates Stella Nash, Francis Leonard, Beric Reid, Jill Clarke, Julian Daly and Richard Curtoys were all political casualties as residents flocked to the polls on Thursday to cast their votes. Results were declared in 20 wards, with 56 seats up for election. 17 wards saw 3 seats filled, 2 wards had 2 seats up for election, and 1 ward had just a single seat in the balance. The first result announced saw Lib Dem Chris Brazier re-elected for Colney Heath ward, before Lib Dems Michael Jones and Simon Mostyn were elected in Marshalswick West, taking the seat from the Conservatives, including sitting councillor Tom Clegg. In the first suggestion that things were not going to go to plan for the Tories, group leader Mary Maynard lost her seat after Lib Dems Dayson Canning, Paul de Court and Pip Liver stormed to victory in Harpenden East. In St Peter's ward, Lib Dems Danny Clare and Jackie Taylor and the Green Party's Simon Grover were elected, while Redbourne was taken by Lucinda Carney, Lib Dem, and David Mitchell, Independent, with Tory Victoria Mead losing her seat. The Lib Dem trio of Ed Moore, Aisha Rahal and Alison Wren were all elected in Harpenden North and Rural ward. Another win over the Conservatives. Cunningham ward was won by Robert Donald, Rowley Everill and Jeff Harrison, all Liberal Democrats, and there was another Lib Dem landslide in Verulam ward with Dawn Gamble, Edgar Hill and Andrew Warwick Thompson elected. Lib Dems Muki Gorar, Emma Matalnley and Sarwar Shamsa were elected in Sopwell ward, with Independent Pia Honey of St Albans Carpets and Flooring Reuse Facebook group one of the candidates who were unsuccessful in winning a seat. Elsewhere, Sinead Howland, Jenny Murray and Liz Needham, all Lib Dems, were elected for Batchwood ward, while in Park Street, Conservatives Stella Nash and Richard Curtoys lost their seats following the election of Lib Dems Syed Abidi, John Parry and Nuala Webb. Liberal Democrats Helen Campbell, Jez Levy and Mangala Patil Mead were elected for Bernard's Heath, and Giles Fry, Ajanta Hilton and Vladimir Jirasek, all Lib Dems, took St Stephen. There were no surprises in Hill End, as Lib Dems Jamie Day, Asmat Mughal and Anthony Rowlands were all elected. But it was farewell to former Tory leader Julian Daly after Lib Dems John Galvin, Fiona Gaskell and Jill Haynes won Harpenden West. The first Conservative victory of the campaign came in London Colney, where Simon Calder won a seat alongside Tony Lillico and Guy Gamble, both Lib Dems, whilst Lib Dem leader Chris White was joined by Josie Maddock and Mark Pedros to take Clarence ward. Against the odds, the Conservatives held on to Harpenden South ward with Mark Beeshall, Brian Ellis and David Heritage, all elected. The final result of the count was for Sandridge and Wheathampstead, where Lynn Cunningham, Christian Gavin and Sharon Hollingsworth, all Lib Dems, were elected. Tory Jill Clark lost her seat.
What next for district Tories after devastating defeat? Before last week's council elections, the St Albans District Conservative Party boasted 23 councillors. Now, they have just 4. Thursday's vote cost them their leader, Mary Maynard, and a host of other veteran councillors. Now barely able to offer any sort of substantial opposition, the party faces the prospect of watching the all-controlling Liberal Democrat administration having carte blanche to introduce its political agenda unopposed. New leader of the Conservative opposition group, Councillor Brian Ellis, responded to the change in status quo. From a governance perspective, the situation looks unhealthy. The normal controls will not work. For example, on the Audit Committee, the Liberal Democrats will be marking their own homework. The administration can do what they like, unchecked. Nevertheless, we intend to provide an intelligent opposition. Whilst there are only 4 of us, several of our former councillors with deep knowledge of the council's operations will remain engaged and will support us. This will be useful as most of the senior staff have left the council. His predecessor, Mary Maynard, had her own thoughts on why things went so terribly wrong. Clearly, the election results were deeply disappointing to all Conservative candidates. They stood to make a difference and help their communities. Some had been councillors for decades, were totally dedicated to helping people in their wards, and had made significant contributions to the district. The district has lost a massive amount of experience and expertise with their departure. The results were not a surprise, though. Conservatives talked to thousands of local people in the months running up to the election, and these doorstep conversations told us 2 things. The first was that people liked the local Conservative agenda and appreciated what we had achieved locally. The second was that, irrespective of this, they were unhappy about what was happening nationally, wanted to send a message to the Conservative government and intended to vote against us to do so. Even lifelong Conservative voters told us this. They did not lend their vote to anyone. They do not really support other parties. They voted to send a warning to government. Most of these people told us that they would come back to us if we listened. We know that this happened in many areas of the Southeast. Looking forward, it is clear the government is listening and is changing policy as a result. For example, they have just announced that in districts like ours, with a high proportion of green belt, councils can make a case not to build in their local plans and do not have to meet their housing targets. The consequence of the election locally is that we are now living in a one-party state with an administration that has shown time and time again over the last 3 years that it does not tolerate opposition or dissent and will ruthlessly try to stamp it out. They cannot evade responsibility or accountability for their actions now. Ousted colleague Richard Curtoys added, "We now have a council with no scrutiny and no local planning committees, both of which were scrapped by the Lib Dems with the blessings of the current Green and Independent councillor, who effectively shored up the last administration. I am sure they will be rewarded for their loyalty by Councillor White in this administration. As for the good people of St Albans City and District, I say brace yourselves for city centre road closures, hikes in council tax charges, and the very real prospect of a journey towards council insolvency, which, due to their obsession with secrecy, will no doubt not be made public until they can find someone else to blame. I am sure a well-meaning council officer may have the sense to blow the whistle." Harpenden MP Bim Afalami has vowed to engage with local voters and find out why they dealt a bloody nose to the Tories at the elections. To put it mildly, these elections did not go brilliantly for the Conservatives. Alongside our local candidates, I campaigned very hard across the area, in the towns of Hitchin, Harpenden and in the villages. The main thing I heard was disappointment about the Conservative government's handling of some issues, like Partygate or the sleazy behaviour of some MPs in Westminster, as well as concern about the cost of living, interspersed with a recognition that we have been dealt, with COVID and Ukraine, one of the worst hands of any government in many decades. Many people told me that they were voting for other parties because they want to send a message or protest vote. I have heard them. He has promised to act differently in response to the results. I will redouble my efforts to speak to and spend time with as many constituents as possible. I love engaging with people and understanding what I and the government need to do in order to take things forward in a better direction.
Remembering the lost railway line between St Albans and Hatfield. Did you know that Hatfield and St Albans used to be connected by a railway line? The tracks are long gone, but footage of the branch still exists. Opened on September 1st, 1865, the line had 8 trains in each direction as part of their weekday services. The journey between towns took 15 minutes, with the route taking in a number of stops, including Lemsford Road Halt and Smallford. The opening of the Midland Main Line through St Albans in 1868 quickly led to financial problems, and it was absorbed into the Great Northern Railway. By the 1930s, further train lines and bus transport saw a decline in customer numbers, with passenger services coming to an end in September 1939, although goods trains continued to support the needs of the de Havilland Aircraft Company. Passenger trains returned post-war, only to be scrapped again in 1951, while goods trains, mainly carrying coal for the St Albans Gasworks, continued until the line was permanently closed in 1968. After track lifting in 1969, the councils of Welland, Hatfield and St Albans purchased a track bed for conversion into a footpath and cycle track, with the footpath now known as Alban Way opening on April 17, 1988. And there's a photo of this story of a train making its way through Smallford Station while travelling the St Albans to Hatfield railway line. There's also some film footage of the Hatfield and St Albans railway taken just before it closed in 1968, showing a large part of the line, including the Hatfield Station, the Ellenbrook Lane level crossing, Smallford Station, Fiddlebridge sidings, and the Lemsford Road bridge and halt.
This week's Hearts Advertiser has lots of letters to the editor. At the top of the letters page, there is this heartfelt plea. We need provision for more allotments. It is with dismay that I heard that St Stephen's allotments are to be turned into a car park, especially since there is a chronic shortage of allotments in the St Albans area. This flies in the face of what needs to be happening in our society. As we only have a few years to do anything effective about runaway climate change, we should be doing everything possible to prevent this happening. Shouldn't we be moving towards more sustainable forms of transport in view of air pollution and climate change? As far as I know, not one centimetre of cycle track has been built since the start of COVID in 2019. You wouldn't think that we are in a world of pending food shortages, at least partly thanks to the war in Ukraine, not to mention the effects of Brexit, and that vast sections of the UK population are faced with the choice of heating or eating. There should be provision for more allotments, not fewer. Is the area a secret colony of extraterrestrials who know nothing of what goes on planet Earth? Or simply a case of that lovely old adage, Hartford-born, Hartford-bred, strong in the arm and weak in the head? It is true that allotment holders concerned are to be given new plots. But is that a fair swap? After years, in some cases decades, of nurturing the soil, working hard to improve the quality, caring for fruit trees, years of investing their own blood and sweat to improve their allotment. Having to move after nurturing a plot for so many years must be especially burdensome for anyone who is older. Speaking as an allotment holder myself, perhaps more thought should be given to the benefits of allotments other than merely growing vegetables. Benefits to biodiversity, the myriad benefits to physical and mental health, the opportunity to design your own space as you like and develop your own creativity. Besides, allotments are very racially diverse, multicultural places. We might have disagreements at times, but we can still manage to get along together. We can also learn from each other. I, for one, am grateful to my Spanish and German allotment neighbours, so I have the opportunity to maintain these languages. I also have Mandarin-speaking allotment neighbours, so I get roped into learning Mandarin as well. Letter from Phil Fletcher, Green Party candidate for Cunningham Ward in the 2022 local elections, and Juliette Voisy, allotment holder and member of the Committee of Butterfly World.
A letter from Vanessa Gregory, Chair of Look St Albans. As Look St Albans, part of SustFest 2022, we are delighted to be hosting Steve and Joseph's talk on St Albans District Transport, Getting Out of the Jams, on Tuesday, May the 17th, starting at 7 p.m, to which we hope many people with a keen interest in the subject will join us. At the time of arranging this at the turn of the year, traffic, pedestrianisation, low-traffic neighbourhoods, together with the ongoing growth of new homes in the district, were particularly hot topics of debate and discussion. I was asked by a number of our supporters if we could arrange some sort of event to discuss these issues in a more calm and measured way. I was delighted Stephen readily agreed to our invitation. Stephen Joseph OBE is a local man and an expert transport policy advisor and visiting professor at the University of Hertfordshire. Therefore, he not only has a wealth of experience of the subject, but first-hand knowledge of the situation within the city and district. Stephen has said that the traffic jams regularly seen across the St Albans district are not inevitable, and the district's car dependence needs to be tackled anyway to reduce carbon emissions. He will present some immediate ways forward that can start to reduce traffic across the district, based on projects elsewhere in Hertfordshire and other counties. He will also talk about links with planning policies through his involvement with the Transport for New Homes project. I've had the pleasure of hearing Stephen speak several times, and I am extremely pleased that Look can enable more local people to hear his expert views and he will be happy to take questions. You can find out how to book through the Sustainability Festival booklet or by emailing lookstalbans@gmail.com. The talk will be online, and once booked, a link to the event will be sent to you. I very much look forward to welcoming you to the free talk and discussion.
Here's a letter sent by email from Jay Batty on the continuing debate about our local hospitals. What on earth is happening at West Harts Teaching Hospitals Trust? We are being asked to comment on detailed redevelopment proposals for a once-in-a-generation transformation of our healthcare, conceived over a period of a number of years, within a matter of a mere 15 days. Moreover, the three most senior officers responsible for redevelopment are all leaving the trust around the same time. The latest board papers indicate that the CEO is effectively retiring before the decisive meeting on May 31st. That meeting is intended to ratify and launch the outlined business case for redevelopment to be put to the Department for Health and ultimately the Treasury, and yet the CEO who has overseen its formulation will not be present, and her successor, charged with implementation, runs the risk of being presented with a fait accompli. Meanwhile, the most recent set of board papers suggest a continuing decline in clinical performance, both in absolute terms and relative to the Trust's peer group. The residents of West Harts deserve some explanations.
And now for another letter. This time it's from Margaret Charleston in Harpenden, and she entitles her letter, Stop Using Peat. This time last year, I wrote in this column asking why we are still using peat in our gardens. Peat bogs are amazing, are equivalent of a tropical rainforest. They store vast amounts of carbon, support lots of wildlife, and help reduce flooding. Yet, in spite of a 12-year voluntary code and vague promises to ban peat for compost, we are still digging them up at an alarming rate. The government has recently carried out a consultation on banning the use of peat by 2024. Why do we have to wait so long? Why are we still at the consultation stage? The evidence is overwhelming. Peat is best left in the ground. Dig it up and habitats are destroyed. Carbon is released and there is more flooding. Is that really what we want? There is something we can all do. First, make sure that any compost you buy is peat-free. Check the small print carefully. It must say peat-free. Second, write to your MP, urging them to support DEFRA's proposed ban on horticultural peat. Thank you.
Another letter. This one is about the closing of the Spicer Street toilets. I was very disappointed to see the Spicer Street toilets now permanently closed. I had read that closing both those and the toilets by the lake were being considered, but fully expected some greater analysis of how that would impact the area, and also what residents close by thought about it. After all, they've been there for decades, and once they're gone forever. We're soon to see an 18-month trial of the pedestrianisation of George Street. This will hopefully lead to an increased use of the street by pedestrians, and will no doubt see the return of evening street events such as we enjoyed last summer. The cathedral offers the only practical alternative to these public toilets. It seems unfair for staff there to have to cater for visitors entering the building for that purpose only, and, in any event, the building closes in the late afternoon. This leaves the Romeland Cemetery as the closest emergency option. I'm sure the pubs and restaurants on George Street will soon tire of non-patrons popping in just to use the loo. Personally, I think the period style of the toilets is an important feature of the conservation area. Yes, they're probably expensive to maintain, but so is every other building in the vicinity. It's the conservation area. I hope this decision isn't final, and that consideration will be given to a stay of execution until after the trial has ended. Letter from Simon Thwaites.
Here's a letter that brings together concerns about the environment and the tragedy of the war in Ukraine. Sunflower oil. Our splendid fish and chip shop in Harpenden say that they fry in sunflower oil. The Ukraine and Russia have 55% of the world's acreage of sunflowers. Ukraine is the world's largest producer and pressed 19 million tons of seeds in 2020. That is about half a ton per Ukrainian citizen. Early predictions were that about half the production will be lost in 2022. Unfortunately, most was shipped through ports in the south of the country. However, the Russian retreat to the east may allow a bit more sowing in April and May. Ukraine is the largest producer of noble gases, including neon and krypton. These are essential for making chips, not the sort of chips that are served with fish, obviously. Following what happened at Mariupol Steelworks, that source of inert gases is destroyed, whilst we remain gravely cognizant of the iniquitous loss of lives. A locally produced alternative cooking fat is English rapeseed oil. The price of rape oil in the supermarket does look a bit steep, though. In 2021, I saw few crops of rape in our area and assumed that this was caused by the 2018 banning of insecticides. This year, Hertfordshire is painted a sunny yellow again with many healthy-looking crops. The insecticides were not really toxic to the bees in the field, but did disrupt their foraging behaviour. The flowering of rape only lasts a couple of weeks, and so the bees would anyway have to spend the other 50 weeks foraging elsewhere. We can thank Rothamsted Research in Harpenden for pioneering the radar techniques to study the foraging of bees, which ultimately led to the ban. Unlike rape, sunflowers diligently follow the sun from east to west each day. Let this be a powerful symbol of hope in this year of wicked events. From Peter Nichols, Newton Close, Harpenden.
A letter from Eric Roberts of Fishbourne Street about pedestrianisation. Like many other people, I found myself walking in the road along George Street the other day. We had got used to it being pedestrianised. Since its recent reopening to traffic, not so. Old habits die hard. The pavements along George Street are narrow, too narrow. Pedestrianisation solved this problem. If the powers that be cannot, will not, bite the bullet and return this attractive historic street into a pedestrian-friendly space, especially at weekends, then I suggest making it one way, perhaps just for Mondays to Fridays. That would enable the pavement to be widened, thus allowing pedestrians to stroll, browse and pass with some space for traders to display their wares outside. The current parking at the west bottom end of the street could remain with a disabled person space. Which direction the traffic might flow, I favour west to east, bottom to top, as this would act as some self-enforcing speed calming, I leave for so-called traffic experts to decide, along with local preference. Instead of yet more procrastination, consultation, could the authorities get on with producing that greener, pedestrian-friendly St Albans? And whilst in this vicinity, I have noticed several people inconvenienced by the closure of public toilets at the corner of George and Spicer Streets and the use of the nearby bushes in Romeland to bring relief. Not such a good decision by the council to close them, especially in a city supposedly trying to attract visitors. Please think again.
And for our final letter, a slightly tongue-in-cheek comment from John Churcher of St Albans. It's headed Election Results. I am grateful to ex-councillor Mary Maynard, Hearts Ad Online, May 10th, 2022, for her accurate analysis of why people voted as they did in this district a week ago. However, a truly frank and honest assessment of the current political situation needs only one word, locally, to be changed to, in 2019, to acknowledge the frustration that so many of us feel. The consequence of the election in 2019 is that we are now living in a one-party state, with an administration that has shown time and time again over the last 3 years that it does not tolerate opposition or dissent and will ruthlessly try to stamp it out. They cannot evade responsibility or accountability for their actions now.
Celebrating important people from history with blue plaques. Eric Roberts of St Albans Civic Society on commemorating people from our city's past. There's no doubt that the Blue Plaque St Albans initiative is extremely popular. The number of people who turned up for the unveiling of the plaques commemorating John Ball and Nathaniel Cotton was impressive. There are more to follow, including Sarah Churchill and Stephen Hawking. Full marks to the organisations, the Society is pleased and proud to be one of them, that have been supportive in making things actually happen. Maybe the COVID years and the impact they are having have made us think a little more about people and things previously taken somewhat for granted. And that would include our local history and characters and where they all fit in with things. St Albans has a rich heritage of events and people, something that has hitherto perhaps not been promoted enough. Publicity has tended to focus on the cathedral, the various Roman remains, Verulamium and the erstwhile Great Charter Markets. But just as the cathedral, now with its award-winning Welcome Centre, is reminding people of the importance of St Alban as the first Christian martyr, so it is appropriate to recall all those other notable figures who have been associated with our city over the years. It makes a lot of sense to do so, especially for image and appeal, so as to attract more visitors, thus helping boost the local economy. One person needing a higher profile is that man called Samuel Ryder. It is over 20 years at least when, at a tourism meeting, the city then had a tourism officer, it was suggested more should be done to commemorate this remarkable man of business, religion, civic and eventually golfing heritage. Good idea, said everyone, but things have moved on very slowly. As an interim measure, the Society helped produce a Samuel Ryder trail, which has been reprinted and is obtainable free from the museum gallery. But wait, there's now talk of not only a blue plaque, but even a statue once again. As the world returns to some normality, enabling foreign travel, the magnet of Samuel Ryder would surely draw in many more people. Heritage can indeed pay dividends and give everyone a welcome boost in their civic pride. After all, we deserve it.
My next piece is remembering St Albans City football legend Ivor Hotshot Jones, who was buried on Wednesday, prompting many memories of his association with the foundation of the Hearts Advertiser Sunday Football League at its start-up in 1961. Ivor played for Gibbs and Bamforth, the printers in Spencer Street, in his first season and went on to play for a mainly teenage group of youngsters, Paupers on Sundays and Selby on Saturdays. These two clubs reached the very highest standard just below St Albans City FC and won many trophies. Tony Lloyd, who played with Ivor for over 11 years as the goalkeeper to both teams, said he believed Ivor's nickname Hotshot was because Tony never in all these years saw him miss a penalty. Getting his signature to join a club was eagerly sought after, hence he played for other teams including London Road Reserves, Fleas and the Peahen Hotel. And there's a picture with this piece of the Paupers team featuring Ivor Jones, Dave Smith, Tony Lloyd, Mick Lewis, Tony Mardor, Kelvin Corran, Barry Harlow, Dave Hegarty, Jock Knipe and Reg Smith.
There's a picture of four ladies beautifully dressed up and they are the cast of Breakaway's production of Ladies Day. It's entitled Hilarious Ladies Day Under Starter's Orders After the Pandemic Delay. And they're off. Breakaway Theatre Company is finally bringing Ladies Day to the St Albans stage, more than 2 years after it was originally scheduled. Just weeks before it was meant to run in March 2020, the feel-good comedy drama had to be put on hold due to lockdown. But now it will run at the Maltings Theatre from Thursday, May the 19th to Saturday, May the 21st, including a Saturday matinee. Like many other things, the play had to be cancelled due to the pandemic, said Joint Director Joe Baker. We had to dust off scripts, relearn lines, and tighten up the play after the prolonged break from the stage. We are so excited to now finally perform it, and it's been a delight to bring the cast back together and work with co-director Leslie Cowland again. It's such a lovely, heartwarming play and sure to be very popular with audiences. Amanda Whittington's play focuses on four fish packers from Hull, Pearl, Jan, Shelley and Linda, as the friends put on their best hats to go to Ladies' Day at Royal Ascot when it relocated to York in 2005. As the races begin, the alcohol flows and a little flutter morphs into a big flap as the lives, loves and losses of these working-class ladies begin to show their flaws. But if their luck holds, they could hit the jackpot. Joint director Leslie added, "This play really warms the cockles of your heart. This is a play about friendship across generations, sisterly support and love above everything else. We hope everyone who had tickets for the original 2020 production will come to see it now, plus anyone who fancies a good night out, a bit of escapism, plenty of laughs and the excitement of a day at the races." The production is especially poignant for Breakaway, as it is being dedicated to the play's original director, Jill Hardman, who lost her battle with cancer and died suddenly in February. Joe Baker and Leslie Cowland have taken over directing duties and are determined to do justice to Jill's version for the play. There will be a collection at the show for cancer research. There is news about a cathedral concert. St Albans Symphony Orchestra, brackets SASO, returns to the magnificent setting of the cathedral with a programme of orchestral and choral works that will make the most of the historic building's acoustics and organ. SASO will be joined by the vocal group Gloriana and soprano Jessica Kale on Saturday, May the 14th. Gloriana will open the concert at 7:30 p.m. with Poulenc's a cappella Ave Verum Corpus, the setting of a Eucharistic chant. The orchestra will then play Debussy's evocative nocturne, joined by voices of Gloriana in the last of three movements. Jessica Kale will join the orchestra for Chants d'Auvergne, folk songs from the Auvergne region, arranged by Joseph Conteloup. After the interval, the singers of Gloriana will be accompanied by the cathedral organ in Cantique de Jean Racine by Gabriel Fauré. The evening will finish with Camille Saint-Saëns' flamboyant Symphony No. 3, the organ symphony unleashing the full power of the 4,500 pipe organ.
And here, from the Hearts Advertiser's historical section online, is a local musical piece from the past, and it's headed Mick Taylor, Hyde Park, and his first gig with the Rolling Stones. July 5th, 1969, saw the Rolling Stones take to the stage for the first time in 2 years for a huge festival at Hyde Park. They had a new guitarist too, Welwyn Garden City's Mick Taylor. The 20-year-old had joined the band earlier that year to replace Brian Jones, and the Stones in the Park concert was planned to introduce him. But Jones passed away 2 days before the gig and it turned into a tribute. Taylor and the Stones played in front of an estimated audience of 250,000 to 500,000 spectators in the capital, playing hits such as Jumpin' Jack Flash, Honky Tonk Woman, and Street Fighting Man. There was also an 18-minute rendition of Sympathy for the Devil alongside African drummers, with the crowd clambering to get to a strutting Mick Jagger. Following the Hyde Park gig, Taylor would be part of the greatest rock and roll band in the world for classic albums such as Sticky Fingers and Goat's Head Soup, as well as their magnum opus, Exile on Main Street. After returning to the band in late 1973 following an operation, Taylor fell out with Keith Richards, and then just over a year later, in December 1974, he quit, informing Jagger of his decision at a party before walking out.
Brewer marks milestone with US collaboration. Beer expert Roger Protz on how one Suffolk brewery is marking its 150th anniversary by teaming up with the American Craft Brewery to produce a unique beer. Suffolk brewer Adnams celebrates 150 years of brewing in 2022, and it's marking the milestone with a collaboration brew, Eastern Edge, with Sierra Nevada, one of America's leading craft breweries. The name of the 4.8% pale ale reflects the position of Adnams in Southwold on the edge of the North Sea, while the Sierra Nevada Mountains in California form the backdrop to the brewery there. Both breweries also have a keen interest in cask-conditioned beer, sustainability and recycling, which led to talks about a joint brewing operation. Eastern Edge was launched this month with Steve Grossman, Sierra Nevada's beer ambassador, in attendance. The beer is fermented with a mix of yeast from both breweries. Malted barley and rye are grown in Suffolk, with some from the farm on Jonathan Adams, the brewery chairman. Two hops are used, Cascade and Chinook. Both have their origins in the US, but they are now also grown in Herefordshire. Cascade is used to dry hop the beer, which means adding additional hops when casks are filled for extra aroma and bitterness. Eastern Edge has a pale copper colour with pine, biscuit malt, blackcurrant fruit and spicy hops on the aroma. Blackcurrants, honeyed malt and tart hops dominate the palate, followed by a dry finish with a fine melding of fruit, malt and hops. The beer is available in cask, keg and can, and will be on sale in Adnams 36 pubs, the wider free trade and off-sales outlets. Brewing has taken place in and around the Swan Hotel in Southwold since the 14th century. In 1872, Ernest and George Adnams from Essex bought the small plant and turned into a successful commercial enterprise. The modern brewery today can produce 115,000 barrels a year with grain, hops and water, all recycled to aid the environment. A distillery has been added and has won awards for its gin, vodka and whiskey. The photo depicts director Fergus Fitzgerald, Steve Grossman of Sierra Nevada and Adnams head brewer Dan Goodeman all enjoying a glass of their special brew.
Well, thanks to this week's team of readers. There was one item I left out, and this was where the manager of St Albans Football Club was explaining why the club just missed out on getting into the playoffs for promotion. Very sad story. Oh well, there's always next year. Now for a bit more of our musical theme for this week, and then in part two, a number of different items, starting with a discussion about four audiobooks. This was first recorded in 2014, but it's surprisingly relevant today, as you'll soon discover after the music.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife.
Hello, I'm Rob Pym, and welcome to this edition of the Talking Bookshelf. In this programme, we invite one of our Hertfordshire librarians to come in to discuss with us a number of books that either are new releases or are old-time favourites. And there's no more old-time favourite than the one that we've just heard that extract from, perhaps some of the most well-known opening lines in the history of English literature, from Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. We'll come back to that in a minute. First of all, I want to welcome Louise Conway. Her official title is Stock and Reader Development Librarian.
Yes.
Now, you chose four, three of which are fiction.
Yes.
And one of which is reputedly factual. We'll discuss that in a moment. Your first choice is Jane Austen, and we heard that very big, that the famous opening lines of it earlier. Why? What do you like about Jane Austen?
Oh, I just love Pride and Prejudice. I was just thinking, I wanted to have a mix of titles, and I thought, a classic, and I know it so well. But weirdly, I have tried to read the actual book about four or five times, and whether it's just the way it's written or whether I know it so well just from various screenplay adaptations and things, I don't know. I couldn't actually read it as a written word, but listening to it on audio was just brilliant. I loved it. I think it's because I know it so well as something to watch, it's kind of the second. It's very much like
that. It's been done a phenomenal number of times.
Oh yeah, I mean there's various like different versions you can request. I picked one that's read by Lindsay Duncan, and it's really beautifully read as well. She gets the characters even though if you're doing a male character or a female character, you can just differentiate between them all, and it's just fabulous.
Pride and Prejudice is only one of the six novels that Jane Austen wrote in her very short life. I mean, she lived, just for our listeners, I had to check the dates up, from 1775 she was born, she died in 1817, and all of the work that we know, not just Pride and Prejudice, but Sense and Sensibility, Mansfield Park, Emma, Persuasion, I'm looking at my list, Northanger Abbey, just to make sure I don't miss any, and yeah. I probably have, were all written really in about a five-year, or published in a five-year period, although she tried lots of other things first. Didn't really have any great success, and they all came tumbling out in this period, in the last decade of her life, which is quite astonishing. But it's a phenomenal amount of work. She wasn't, of course, in her own lifetime successful, because, of course, writers very often weren't.
No.
Her fame came much later, and in my lifetime, I have listened to radio adaptations, television adaptations, film.
I mean, they're just endless,
versions,
aren't they?
And there's so many of them, and it's one I remember most from my childhood, because there was a slot long before you were born on television at tea time on Sunday, the classic serial in black and white television. And I said, to this day, I remember Pride and Prejudice is one of those. I would rush to there, I guess, 5 or 6 o'clock. I can't remember.
I mean, I guess it's that well known just because it is just so brilliant.
That's right.
And it's just such a lovely story. I don't ever tire of listening to it or watching it.
I mean, you've got to read it. You can't summarise the plot.
No.
I mean, it's really about the Bennet daughters, Elizabeth Bennet, who is actually quite attracted to a wealthy man who comes into the area, but at the same time she's quite put off by him because he's very arrogant.
Yeah.
In one of the famous films, he was played by Colin Firth.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all convoluted, but it's all very subtle, and the language is so subtle, as you say, it's quite difficult to read.
It is, yeah.
Well, let's hear more of that opening section, which, as you say, is read by Lindsay Duncan. We'll start again at the beginning, and we'll run through for a little section of the opening.
Lovely.
It is a truth universally acknowledged that a single man in possession of a good fortune must be in want of a wife. However little known the feelings or views of such a man may be on his first entering a neighbourhood, this truth is so well fixed in the minds of the surrounding families that he is considered as the rightful property of some one or other of their daughters. "My dear Mr. Bennet," said his lady to him one day, "have you heard that Netherfield Park is let at last?" Mr. Bennet replied that he had not. "But it is," returned she, "for Mrs. Long has just been here, and she told me all about it." Mr. Bennet made no answer. "Do not you want to know who has taken it?" cried his wife impatiently. "You want to tell me, and I have no objection to hearing it." This was invitation enough. "Why, my dear, you must know, Mrs. Long says that Netherfield is taken by a young man of large fortune from the north of England, that he came down on Monday in a chaise and four to see the place, and was so much delighted with it that he agreed with Mr. Morris immediately, that he is to take possession before Michaelmas, and some of his servants are to be in the house by the end of next week."
"What is his name?"
"Bingley."
"Is he married or single?"
"Oh, single, my dear, to be sure. A single man of large fortune. 4,000 or 5,000 a year. What a fine thing for our girls."
"How so? How can it affect them?"
"My dear Mr. Bennet," replied his wife, "how can you be so tiresome? You must know that I'm thinking of his marrying one of them."
Well, there we are. That's a wonderful reading and fairly typical rendering, in a way, of this wonderful language that Jane Austen uses. Now, we're going to come into the modern period with your second one. In fact, ironically, given the events in the Ukraine, it's even more contemporary than perhaps we'd planned.
Yes.
Because this novel, which is called A Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian, is probably the most off-putting title of a novel you could ever have. But it's, in fact, very amusing. It is written by a woman whose name I will get wrong, but I believe it's something like Marina Lebka. Mm. She was, in fact, born just after the Second World War in a refugee camp in Germany. A lot of people were moving around Europe at that time, of course, because all the borders were redrawn, including those of Ukrainian itself. But she came to England with her family, and then she studied at university, Kiel University, in fact, and got her degree. And then she went on to the University of York and got various other qualifications. But she was a lecturer in media studies for some time at Sheffield Hallam University, and she has retired from that. She came out with this book, A Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian, which won some prizes for comic writing, because it's an absolute hoot. I mean, I picked it up some, I don't know, when, a couple of years ago, I suppose, and read it. And what made you choose it for this?
I've always been slightly intrigued by the title, but always found other things to read instead. But I found myself sniggering quite a few times while I was listening to the recording. And again, it's a really good one to listen to, because the reader, Sian Thomas, really gets the characters just brilliantly, and her accent is fabulous. I don't know whether she has a background in Russian or anything like that, but her accent is just brilliant. And the 84-year-old dad is just, he's a lovely character, if a little naive. And it's a lovely story of two sisters that are obviously from very different moulds, and how their father copes after his lovely wife passes away. Probably hits home to many people that might have sisters that they might not get on with so well, or just family life in general. And it's just and description is lovely as well. There was a lovely description about all the food that she's had in her pantry, because she's very frugal, the mother that's just passed away, and she's left lots of jars of pickled vegetables and things that she grew in her garden, and just stocks and stocks of tinned meat and things. And I think that comes from being hungry when she was a child and not wanting to fall victim to that again, and to provide for her family, essentially. And
there's obviously elements of autobiography in here.
I would imagine so.
That's why I trailed the fact that she'd been born in a refugee camp. So her background, I don't know anything about her mother. But in the book, she's got, as you say, these two sisters that are very polar opposites. And of course the father, the widowed father, then marries a younger woman, immigrant younger, from the Ukraine. And the narrator, who is the younger of the two daughters, Nadezhda, she's really worried, especially when she meets this rather voluptuous gold digger.
Yes, exactly.
Probably called. And it really sees the two daughters struggling, almost coming to terms with each other's, the differences between them, because they've found a common enemy.
I think so, I wasn't expecting it to be quite as amusing as it was, but I did have a little chuckle every now and then while I was listening to it.
I think it's well worth listening to. I think it's one of those that I enjoyed very much. Yeah. Let's listen to an extract now.
I had thought this story was going to be a knockabout farce, but now I see it as developing into a knockabout tragedy. He hasn't told me before because she listens when he talks on the telephone, and because he doesn't want Vera to know. I resist the temptation to say, "I told you so, stupid man." But I telephone Vera, and she says it for me. "But really, I blame you, Nadezhda," she adds. "You stopped him going into sheltered housing. None of this would have happened if he'd gone into sheltered housing. Nobody could have predicted it. Nadia, I predicted it." Her voice rings with big sis triumph. "Okay, so you're so clever. How are we going to get him out of it?" I pull a mocking face that she can't see on the phone. "Well, there are two possibilities," says Vera. "Divorce or deportation. The first is expensive and uncertain. The second is also uncertain, but at least Papa doesn't have to pay for it." "Can't we go for both?" "How you've changed, Nadia. What's happened to all your feminist ideas?" "Don't be so spiteful, Vera. We should be allies, but you just can't bring yourself to be civil to me, can you? I can understand why Papa never tells you anything." "Yes, well, he's another idiot. Mother and I were the practical people in the family." "See how she claims Mother's legacy? It's not just the cupboard full of tins and jars, nor the gold locket, nor even the money in the savings account she's after. No, it's the inheritance of character, of nature, that we fight over. We never were a very practical family. What is the word you social workers use? A dysfunctional family. Maybe we should apply for a grant from the council."
Well, I think some of the humour comes out there in that extract. As you said, you enjoyed it very much. So two of your four, and ironically, they've both been about daughters in different, very, very different ways. But it's interesting, of course, because Pride and Prejudice is, I think there are six daughters, if my memory serves me correctly, but certainly a lot of them, and they all various different qualities. And they come to different ends, as it were, in the very different social setting from the two in Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian. Now, your third choice is something completely different, because, first of all, it's not a novel.
No.
Although some people say that some of the facts in it are a bit fictional, and that depends where you I put that to somebody I know who knows a lot of history, and he's felt that in the beginning it was a bit dodgy on its territory, but that it got better and better as it went on. In fact, the book is by a chap called John O'Farrell, who is in fact reading it in the order book. It's called An Utterly Impartial History of Britain, and it's got a subtitle, or 2,000 Years of Upper Class Idiots in Charge.
Yes.
Again, what made you pick that one?
Well, this one I've been meaning to read for a long time, so it was a good excuse to borrow it or read it. John O'Farrell has actually been to the library to do talks before in the past, and I've been to listen, and he is very amusing. I can imagine that some of the facts are probably twisted a little bit. Coloured, yes. To kind of prove a point or to kind of fit with his satirical way of viewing the whole of history, basically.
Well, it's British history, really. From its origins through to up to
Second World War, I think, 1945.
And I found it absolutely fascinating. Yeah. I found it by chance about 6 months ago in a charity shop, and read it and thought, this is very odd.
Yes.
And
I think it benefits from being listened to, because being read by John O'Farrell as well, he obviously can read it in the way that it's meant to be read, basically. And I think he also puts on some quite funny little skits, the bits that are the satirical, the play, like the modern take on what's happening in that particular moment in history at the time. It reminds me of Monty Python a little bit and things like that. I think it definitely benefits from having him read it to you. But it's just hilarious, I think. It's like somebody taking the complete works of Shakespeare and doing one of those little plays just on everything that Shakespeare's ever done. He's trying to cram the whole of history into this book, and it's just...
And it's divided, of course, because it's historical, and it goes from like almost year zero to the end of the Second World War, as well.
Yeah.
And so it is a historical flow through. And I think anybody reading this, and I in fact looked up some of the quotes from people who had read it. I love history, and I also like a good laugh. This book hits the spot on both areas. It's the sort of writing I can give my son to read and know he will also chuckle and learn something at the same time.
Yeah.
Brilliantly written. And I think that's the point, isn't it? Because it's actually quite difficult teaching history.
It is.
It's quite difficult reading unless you've got a fascination for it. And most people are turned off history as they are, you referred to Shakespeare. You shouldn't read Shakespeare till at least 20 because puts you off.
Yeah.
And this fellow has managed to convey an entire history of an entire nation in a humorous and yet informative way.
Yes. When you're younger, you can't really see the relevance it plays on your own life at that particular, if you're quite young.
Exactly.
But as you get older, you obviously realise the consequent, what consequences it's had on you and why it is so important. Mm. But something like that does, it just helps it stick in the brain.
Let me give you the couple of titles of sections, because he breaks it all up into these little sections. And the invasion, the arrival of the Romans, he puts under a heading called Kent Young Farmers Association versus Roman Empire.
Yes.
Away win. And the section that we're going to hear from in a moment from him is called Boadicea Rebels Over Incorrect Spelling of Her Name. And there's always been these arguments about how you spell Boadicea, how you pronounce it. I think it's currently called Boudica.
Mm.
But he takes a very light-hearted approach to...
There's a funny little skit in there about that.
Thought for the day, let's kill everyone who disagrees with us. That was the Reformation. And so it goes on. But it's well worth listening to this. And
it
I think
is.
We should let the author, who, as you say, is a satirist, and he's written, one of his earlier books was called Things Can Only Get Better, 18 Miserable Years in the Life of a Labour Supporter.
Uh-huh.
And that was written in 1998. So at the end of being in opposition, he's a Labour supporter, an avowed Labour supporter, but a satirist and a very funny writer. So let's listen to a section of him reading about this section I read as Boadicea rebels over incorrect spelling of her name.
Within 4 years, the Roman armies occupied Britain as far as the Severn and the Trent. The successful campaign was crowned by the public submission of 11 British kings to the Emperor and his triumphant entry into Colchester, complete with a parade of elephants, which was more interesting than anything that has ever happened in Colchester before or since. However, the Roman success on the battlefield was not matched by their skills of diplomacy. Had a regional commander in East Anglia treated the Queen of the Iceni tribe with a little more respect, the Romans might have avoided an uprising that saw tens of thousands of Roman settlers put to the sword. Within a few months, Boadicea was a name that struck fear across the whole province. "Though you're not supposed to say Boadicea anymore," moaned one of the legionaries. "It's Iceniist, apparently. We have to call her Boudica now. Honestly, it's just political correctness gone mad." Boudica's dying husband had left half of his royal possessions to Rome, to ensure that his family and kingdom would be protected. As with all insurance schemes throughout history, however, the Iceni did not get what had already been paid for. Instead, the local commander immediately set about helping himself to the whole lot, including all of the bereaved queen's personal possessions. When Boudica protested, she was flogged. Her teenage daughters were raped, and the Iceni were driven off their land as the invaders began an orgy of destruction. And then the Romans were surprised that she was really, really annoyed. Allying herself with neighbouring tribes, who had many grievances of their own, the striking red-headed queen assembled a force of around 120,000 men, three times the number of the occupying army, most of whom were far away in North Wales. She swept through southern Britain, burning Colchester, St Albans and London. While the Roman army rushed back south and thousands of soldiers were sent over from Germany, her forces were estimated to have killed around 70,000 Roman settlers and sympathisers. Finally, at an unknown location somewhere in the Midlands, the two armies came face to face in the Battle of Watling Street. Almost inevitably, the military tactics of the disciplined Roman army proved superior to the chaotic charges of the assembled chiefs, and despite their massively superior numbers, the Celts were defeated and massacred. Rather than allow her daughters to fall into the hands of the Romans, Boudica persuaded them to drink poison from a golden cup and then took the hemlock herself. When the Roman governor finally beheld the dead queen, he described her as lying peacefully, with an arm around each of her daughters. It's a beautiful and poignant image. The actual effects of hemlock are vomiting and diarrhea, but you have to allow a certain amount of poetic license.
Well, I think that extract read by the author of An Utterly Impartial History of Britain, which I just love this 2,000 years of upper-class idiots in charge. It's a very offensive but very humorous way of describing British history.
Mm.
We had two novels and one history book with a difference, and your fourth choice is going back to the novel. So it's another modern one, and it's by an author I'm now going to admit to my chauvinism, because I'd seen the name Maggie O'Farrell, and I thought, a woman's writer. Never read any of hers. I have to say, I picked this one up because it was on your list, and I thought it was absolutely fantastic.
I loved it. Yeah, I actually got given it to read by my mother-in-law, who suggested that I read it, and I thought, okay, I'll give it a go. But I also liked the sound of it because it's set in 1976, which is the year I was born. As my mother always says, it was a very hot year. It's a lovely story about a family, essentially. They're slightly dysfunctional, Irish family, but living in North London. And it's kind of how the heat has affected the family. And there's a lovely description, which I think we're going to listen to, about how it's so hot and it's just making people kind of act in a slightly strange way. The father has pretty much upped and left, and the mother is beside herself and can't understand where he's gone. They've got a lovely routine. They do the same things every day. She always makes soda bread. And one day he's just left everything behind and he's just disappeared. He's gone out for the morning paper and he doesn't come back. And she's absolutely beside herself. And so it's up to the siblings. There's an older sister, a middle brother and a younger sister, who have to try and find out where he's gone. And they uncover some bits about the family that they didn't know about at all. And the mother's kind of put so far into her subconscious that she's almost forgotten about it as well.
What is so interesting, and sorry for interrupting you there, because I thought that was so interesting the way it was written, is the first four chapters are really about each one of them. I think, if I get it correct, the first one's the mother.
Yeah.
And then each of the three children have a chapter each.
They do.
And that is very clever. It's a device that's been used before, but it works very well because you get into this family from four different angles. And that's clever because then you see that, and again, this links back to some of the other ones that you've chosen, because you see the truth from different perspectives.
Yeah, and you can kind of see why they act the way they do as well. When you find out what's happened individually with each of them, and then it all comes together at the end, you can understand why some of the scenarios have happened, or why the youngest daughter has moved to New York. And you can kind of understand what's happened to each of them individually has affected the family as a whole.
By the time we get to the extract that we're going to play, we've had those four introductory chapters, if you like, and the book, by the way, is called Instructions for a Heat Wave. And I do remember 1976, as many of our listeners will. In fact, it was the year in which my oldest was born, so I remember it as well, and my wife remembers it. It was a difficult time to be pregnant. It was so blooming hot.
Yeah.
So we're going to hear a section in a moment, and it's Maggie O'Farrell's Instructions for a Heat Wave. Who is this read by, this section?
This is read by Patricia Leventon. think she's Irish herself, and she has a lovely, you can just hear the lovely kind of Irish tones coming out and all the characters, and there's some lovely descriptions later on. They go over to Ireland. You won't obviously hear this on the audio tape, but at the end of the book there are some lovely photographs of Connemara and places like that and this island that they go to, and it's really ties the whole thing together. It's lovely.
And it's described by one of the critics as my favourite kind of novel, big-hearted, psychologically complex and utterly gripping, and I go with that. And I'm going to read a lot more of Maggie O'Farrell because I now know she's not she's not just writing for women. She's
no,
a great
exactly.
writer,
yes.
Very successful book. Let's hear this extract from Instructions for a Heatwave by Maggie O'Farrell and read by
Patricia Leventon.
Patricia Leventon, thank you very much.
The thermometers hang from windowsills, from garage walls, from shed roofs, hoarding the heat, waiting. The firefighters are asleep, faces pressed into pillows, fists closed around nothing but bedsheets. Strange weather brings out strange behaviour. As a Bunsen burner applied to a crucible will bring out an exchange of electrons, the division of some compounds and the unification of others, so a heat wave will act upon people. It lays them bare, it wears down their guard. They start behaving not unusually, but unguardedly. They act not so much out of character, but deep within it. A woman at the top of Gillerton Road, a Brownie guide leader, has started meeting the man who runs the newsagents after he closes his shop. The girl next door, a talented student, expected to excel in her A-levels, has stopped attending school and is spending her days in Hyde Park, circling round and round the algae-riddled lake on a pedalo, lighting match after match, letting each one burn down to a blackened wisp. A man who lives opposite has bought himself an Italian scooter. He likes the way he can weave its sleek body in and out of the cars, the way it sings as it accelerates past lumbering buses. He likes the way the hot air and exhaust fumes swoosh over his skin, through his hair. He likes the puttering growl of the engine and the dazzling gleam of the sun off the chrome. And as most people on the street now know, Mr. Reardon at number 14 has disappeared. Just upped and left, and his family have no idea where he's gone or when he's coming back. If he's coming back.
Now, again, you can hear from the extract read there how characterful this is and how well worth listening to. So the most recent of all the four that you've chosen, I mean, it's actually got the Costa Book Award or shortlisted for an award in 2013. So it's very recent to that. It was also picked up by Richard and Judy on their Richard and Judy books. They were very flattering about it. And I'm very grateful, Louise, that you came in.
Oh, it's been
brilliant.
We
had fun chatting through that.
It was nice.
With some enjoyable extracts, and I hope that our listeners have enjoyed it. And we look forward to seeing you and your colleagues progressively over the next few years.
Yes, lovely. Thank you very much for having me.
Now for a look at this coming week's radio highlights, starting with Saturday, May 14th, and a couple of interesting-looking dramas. Broadcast over three consecutive days on Radio 4, The Reckoning, a dramatisation of Charles Nichols' 92 non-fiction book about the death of Christopher Marlowe in what appeared to be a drunken brawl. Tune in to Radio 4 at 3 o'clock, also on Sunday and Monday. Choice at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra features another book dramatisation, William Boyd's A Good Man in Africa, with Alan Rickman as a womanising minor diplomat. It also stars Alison Steadman and Bill Paterson. 5:30 p.m. on Saturday on Radio 4 is a new series of Political Thinking with Nick Robinson, in which the Today presenter interviews major political figures about their lives and careers. To Radio 3 at 6:30 for Opera on 3, English National Opera's production of Vaughan Williams' 1928 comedy Sir John in Love. Falstaff has two problems, no money and no woman. Will Windsor's Merry Wives turn the tables on him? And it's a big night for Eurovision fans, of which there must be many, given that the programme last year attracted 183 million television viewers across Europe and even the world. This year, Ken Bruce presents the Eurovision Grand Final from Turin, with the UK hopes resting on Sam Ryder performing Spaceman. and the party starts at 8 o'clock on Radio 2. Sunday, May 15th, Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs is actor and broadcaster Bradley Walsh. Tune in at 11 a.m. on Radio 4. Poetry Please at 4:30 p.m. on Radio 4 features a range of powerful poems reflecting on disability and by disabled poets. They've been selected by Hannah Hodgson, who has a life-limiting illness and writes remarkable poetry about her experience. We live in a world of automated messages. Your call is important to us. See it, say it, sorted. Thank you for holding, to name just a few. Between the Ears on Radio 3 at 6:45 on Sunday focuses on the multitude of depersonalised messages that accost people on a daily basis and asks whether they amount to more than just a minor irritation. Mind the gap. At 7 p.m. on Radio 2 comes Sunday Night Is Music Night. First broadcast in 2017, Mike Dixon conducts the BBC Concert Orchestra in a 50th anniversary celebration of music featured in films and stage shows from 1967. And this follows on Radio 2 at 9 p.m. by Music Therapy with Edith Bowman, in which she invites guests to discuss the songs that have helped them through difficult or significant moments. Here she's joined by Shaznay Lewis of singing group All Saints and comedian and broadcaster Richard Ayodi. On to programmes then that are broadcast every day, Monday to Friday at the same time. Same radio station, same time, all week, Monday to Friday. Book of the Week at 9:45 on Radio 4 each day is Empire of Pain, Patrick Radden Keefe's award-winning book telling the saga of three generations of the Sackler family and their involvement in the opioid crisis in the USA. It is an absorbing tale of a family who made a $14 billion fortune and whose name has now been dropped from major galleries around the world, including the Tate and the British Museum. The first episode is entitled A Good Name. Radio 3's Composer of the Week is Vaughan Williams. In the 150th anniversary of his birth, Donald MacLeod focuses on the years 1931 to 1947, a dramatic period not just in Williams' life, but in the wider world too. Tune in to Radio 3, 12 noon, each day. Also all week, at 1:45 on Radio 4, The Future Will Be Synthesized, in which Henry Adjar examines the legal, political and ethical implications of a synthetic society. The first episode looks at the use of deepfakes in pornography, when a person in an existing image or video is replaced with somebody else's likeness. There are a couple of dramas on Radio 4 Extra which may be of interest. At 2 o'clock each day is Clock Dance, Anne Tyler's 2018 novel about family and self-discovery set in 1967. It's followed at 2:15 each day by William Makepeace Thackeray's satirical 1848 novel, Vanity Fair, narrated by Stephen Fry. And of course, you can't end the highlights every day of the week, Monday to Friday, without mentioning Book at Bedtime. This week, Mira Sayal reads Monica Ali's novel, Love Marriage, in which two families, one a traditional Muslim and the other a firebrand feminist mother, are brought together by marriage. It's on every night, 10:45, on Radio 4. On to the rest of the week's highlights then, starting with Monday, May 16th. Untold at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 is entitled Island Warden Wanted. This week, since 2018, Matt Brown has been the warden of Flat Home, an island in the British Channel of just 600 metres, mainly populated by gulls. But after 4 years of island life, he's decided it's time to return to the mainland. Who will take this unique job? Radio 4's Just a Minute returns this week. Sue Perkins is in the chair. And her guests are Paul Merton, Tony Hawks, Pippa Evans and Susie Ruffle. Tune in at 6:30 p.m. And then at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, London on the Line looks at how, a decade on from the highs of the 2012 Olympics, the capital is struggling. The government is focused on levelling up outside the city. COVID has ripped through its economy. Dr. Jack Brown from King's College London looks at how the capital can be revived, starting in Waltham Forest, across the road from the Olympic Park. Tuesday, May 17th, in The Long View at 9 a.m. on Radio 4, Jonathan Friedland takes a look at the news through the lens of history. He talks to historians about past events that have a great deal in common with those of today. At 11 a.m. on Radio 4 comes Putin, Entitled Preying on Hopes and Fears, this final episode in the series looks at how in 2021 the Russian leader retreated to his bunker as the COVID-19 pandemic spread through Russia. Johnny Diamond discusses how this isolation affected his thinking and his decision to invade Ukraine. The drama 215 on Radio 4 is An Accident That Wasn't Your Fault, a gentle romance about taking control of destiny. A chance encounter in a random phone call may prove good fortune or bad luck for Jess and Lydia. Radio 3 in Concert features Beethoven's Overture Leonora No. 3, Sibelius's Violin Concerto and Prokofiev's Symphony No. 5. 19-year-old violinist Maria Dunas joins Domingo Hindian as he conducts the Royal Liverpool Philharmonic Orchestra, recorded in April at the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall. Radio 3, 7:30 p.m. Alternatively, File on 4 at 8 on Radio 4 looks at the UK's Homes for Ukraine scheme. More than 150,000 people signed up to this, hoping to open their doors to those desperately fleeing the war. In Ukraine Taking in the Trauma, Adrian Goldberg investigates the difficulties the scheme is facing, examines how schools, councils and health services are coping with the arrival of so many traumatised families. And at 8:40, as it's Tuesday, In Touch with Peter White, news, views and information for people who are blind or partially sighted on Radio 4. Wednesday, May 18th, in Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley. This week, Lucy reinvestigates the case of servant Grace Marks, who was accused of murdering her master Thomas Kinnear and his housekeeper Nancy in Canada in 1843. Grace insisted she was innocent, but when the police found her, she was wearing the clothing of the woman she was suspected of killing. Drama at 2:15 on Radio 4, Red Lines, a fact-based drama co-written by David Cameron's former head of communications, Craig Oliver, and historian Anthony Seldon. We get the inside scoop on how Cameron and Barack Obama failed to implement the red line that was crossed when President Assad used chemical weapons during the Syrian civil war in 2013, aided and abetted by Vladimir Putin. Thinking Aloud at 4 p.m. on Radio 4 this week is entitled COVID and asks whether the pandemic has led to lasting transformation in our way of living and working. If you're into football, you may be keen to tune in to this year's Europa League final. German club Eintracht Frankfurt against Scottish club Rangers. Coverage 7 p.m. on Radio 5 Live. Kickoff at 8 o'clock. Alternatively, at 8 on Radio 4 comes Generation Change, in which Samira Ahmed and Catherine Rake bring together activists from different generations, united in their fight for decent social housing and end to poverty in Britain. Thursday, May 19th, Crossing Continents this week is entitled Is the War in Ukraine Uniting Estonia? A quarter of Estonians are ethnically Russian, and although Estonia's border with Russia, there are whole cities, like Narva, where the vast majority speak Russian. Many people wondered whether Narva would be next to be invaded. Now a new generation of Russian-speaking Estonians are signing up to the country's volunteer defence force. Musicians and artists are bringing the Tallinn Music Festival to Narva for the first time, using culture to unite Estonians. Radio 4 at 2:15, the drama Our Friends in the North continues. We're now into 1984 and the miners' strike dominates political life throughout the country. It's followed on Radio 4 at 3 by Claire Balding's Ramblings. This week, she embarks on the first of two hikes in the Mourne Mountains, heading from Bloody Bridge near Newcastle on the coast, up into the hills. And we round off Thursday, Radio 3, in concert, 7:30 p.m, City Hall, Glasgow, with the British Scottish Symphony Orchestra playing works by Nielsen, Symphony No. 4, The Inextinguishable, and Mozart's Clarinet Concerto in A, K622. And Friday, May 20th, Sketches, Stories of Art and People. The writer Anna Freeman hears stories of people using their creativity to pay tribute to others. There's the Leeds-based writer and musician using song to honour elderly members of the local community. An art teacher drawing every member of the British Armed Forces who've lost their lives in recent conflicts. You can hear it at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 on Friday. It's followed on Radio 4 at 11:30 by Believe It, John Cantor's fictional biography of Richard Wilson, narrated by the actor and featuring dramatised scenes from his untrue life story. Richard in this episode decides it's time to declutter his life. The drama Lucis continues on Radio 4 at 2:15. Magnus is a surgeon who secretly believes he doesn't do his daily rituals, his parents will die. We follow Magnus through the habitual voicemail messages he leaves for his ex-girlfriend, but with each day she doesn't answer, his rituals are further interrupted. Screen Shop at 7:15 on Radio 4 is entitled Box Office Bombs, a look at the big-budget cinematic flops from the 1987 comedy Ishtar to the recent feline fiasco Cats. And we finish the week with 3 hours of smooth classics with Margarita Taylor from 10 o'clock on Classic FM. Or you may want to tune in to a late-night recommendation composed with Emily Sandé, in which the singer-songwriter shares the music that brings her strength and inspiration. It's a late one. It's at 1 a.m. on Radio 3. That's it for this week. May I wish you a peaceful, safe and enjoyable week of radio listening.
TNF Soundings. Features from across the UK.
Hello everyone, this is 10 Today, a 10-minute set of exercises to do at home to help keep yourself active. Before we get to today's presenter, a couple of housekeeping points to note. The 10 Today project is funded by the Big Lottery and Sport England, and when you're doing the exercises, it's important that you don't push yourself too far, and by taking part, you agree to 10 Today's terms and conditions. You can read these terms and conditions at tnflink.uk/10T, and the 10T is the digit 1, the digit 0, and the letter T. And please remember that you agree to take part at your own risk. Today's exercises are brought to you by Liz, and here she is.
Hello everyone, and welcome to 10 Today, Series 2, Session Number 1. These are short, 10-minute physical activity routines which will get you moving and stretching. They're great for your health, including boosting your mood, and very importantly, they are designed to support your everyday movements, your functional fitness, your flexibility, balance, and mobility, such as when you have to reach up, turn, bend down, and so on. These simple routines will help you with that. Just take them at your own pace. There are plenty of options. If an exercise feels too much, then just take it easy and have a break. All the exercises can be done either standing up or sitting down, so just do whatever feels good for you today. When lifting your arms or knees, only go as far as is comfortable. If you have any problems with your knees or hips, take care not to twist them during the movements. It can also help to pull in your tummy when you're bending your back. And just breathe normally throughout these activities. We want you all to do these activities safely. You are responsible for monitoring how you're feeling throughout the sessions. If you feel any discomfort or pain, for example, if you feel unwell or dizzy, or experience palpitations, then please stop and seek medical advice. If you're remaining seated, it would be ideal if you can use a hard chair, preferably one without arms, such as a dining chair that you can sit upright in, with a straight back and with your feet flat on the floor. If you're standing, just keep your feet hip-width apart, relax your shoulders and take a good strong stance. And you might want to have a sturdy chair nearby to hold on to sometimes for balance. So we're just going to start with a warm-up. You're just going to quickly tap or pat different parts of your body. So briefly tap along each arm, one at a time in different places. Your upper arm, your forearm, and your wrist. Do the same on both arms. Then pat the top of both legs, just quickly tapping up and down your legs in various places towards your knees for a few seconds. You should be nicely warmed up now and ready to move. So we're going to start with supporting the sky. This one works the upper body, so just face forwards and keep your back nice and straight. If you're sitting, remember to keep both feet flat on the floor. Now raise both arms straight up in the air, pushing up towards the sky and with your palms facing upwards. Then bring both arms down together, turning your palms downwards and keep pushing them down towards the floor. And again, raise both arms straight up, extending them towards the ceiling, palms facing up and then coming down, with palms facing down and pushing towards the floor. Do this a few more times now. Try to get your arms as straight as you can. You can reach higher if you are able to, and you can really push down, but always make sure you feel comfortable. There are lots of benefits to this one. It's good for your arms and shoulders, also your back and chest, as well as your wrists. Next, it's knee to core. This movement's great for improving your balance. If you're standing, you can hold on to a sturdy chair for balance. So, in the usual starting position, with your feet hip-width apart and shoulders relaxed, just face forwards with your arms down by your sides and keep your back nice and straight. Now lift your right leg, bending your knee and raising it towards your chest. Hold that position briefly and bring your foot down to the floor again. Now lift up your left leg, raise your knee towards your chest, hold briefly and bring it down again. Repeat this a few more times. It's a bit like marching on the spot, but slower and with both arms down by your sides. If you want to work a little harder, you can lift your legs higher just as far as is comfortable, and you can lean slightly towards your knees to put a bit of a pull in your lower back. Just alternate your legs, lifting up and back down. This is good for your legs, hips, and core muscles. Now it's time for Through the Mist. This one's like swimming the breaststroke. So stretch both your arms out directly in front of you at shoulder height and with your palms facing outwards a few inches apart. Then, keeping your feet facing forward, twist your upper body to the left. Now pull both arms back in line with your shoulders and bend your elbows, then push your arms out again, just as if you're doing a breaststroke or trying to part the mist. So again, facing to the left, arms straight out and palms facing out. Pull back your arms, bend your elbows, then start again. We'll do a few more on the left and then repeat the movement on your right side. Don't put too much stress on your knees. So both arms stretched out in front of you, feet facing forwards. Twist to the side, then pull those arms back. You can lean more into it if you like, and you can pull your arms further back against your shoulder blades. A couple more now. Great work. This is really good for the chest, shoulders, arms, and core. The next one is called Charge Fists. This is a martial arts type of movement that works your chest and core, arms, and shoulders. So whether you're standing or sitting, make two fists and bend both arms at the elbow as if you're getting ready for a fight, bringing your fist up towards your shoulders. Then just push your right arm forward, keeping it nice and straight at shoulder level. Pull it back towards your body and then punch forward with your left arm. So carry on with this. You're just punching forward with one arm at a time, alternating your arms each time. You can lean into it and put a bit of power and aggression into that punching arm if you like, or punch a little higher. Now it's time for high toes. So, facing forwards, with your feet a comfortable distance apart, just raise both heels off the ground, going up into the balls of your feet and raising both arms at the same time, bending them down at the elbow as you raise them up. Then bring your heels and arms back down again at the same time. And do this again, keeping it nice and slower. The slower the better. This is good for your balance and your core, and you should feel it pulling your calves. Just keep going slowly up and down into the balls of your feet and a bit higher into your toes if you can. If you're seated, you can lean slightly forwards in your chair and feel it going through your legs. The next one is forest to sky. So lean forward slightly, and if you're standing, bend your knees a little way. Now, with a nice sweeping movement, lower your right arm down towards your left leg. Then sweep your arm slowly back up to the right as you straighten up, stretching your arm above your head. Then bring it back down to your side and swap to the other arm. So lean forwards, bend your knees, and this time lower your left arm down towards your right leg and sweep it back up again to the left. So keep going with this, alternating your arms, lowering one arm at a time down towards the opposite leg and stretching it back up high and then back down by your side. This is good for your back, shoulders, arms and core. Now it's connect with the earth. Starting from the usual position, with your feet hip width apart and arms down by your sides. Bend both wrists upwards so your fingers point forwards and your palms face down. Then, bending your knees at the same time, push your arms down towards the floor. Then straighten up and pull your arms back with the palms still facing down and elbows bent, tucking them in close to the sides of your body. Repeat this a few more times. If you're seated, press down to your feet and also focus on the arm movements, pushing down and pulling up. Keep going, just a couple more times. Well done. Now it's time for weighing the grain. Raise both arms and stretch them out to each side, keeping them at shoulder level, palms facing down. Then tilt so that one arm goes up as the other comes down, a bit like an aeroplane. Then come back to the centre and tilt to the other side, just as if you're weighing the grain on each arm. Alternate from left to right for a few more times. This one's great for your arms, hips, legs and chest, as well as your shoulders. To make it more challenging, try to make one arm go lower and the other go higher. Great. The next one is called the border and beyond. From the usual starting position, step your right foot forward with the knee slightly bent into a lunge position with your training leg naturally raised on its toes. Take care that your bent knee isn't further forward than your toes. Then stretch your arms out together in front of you with your palms facing forward in a pushing motion, as if you're blocking or pushing someone away. Keep your arms straight and at shoulder height and then step back, bringing your arms back at the same time. Then switch to the left leg, stepping forward into a lunge and pushing your arms out in front, nice and slowly. Keep going with this, alternating your legs between right and left. You can do a longer or deeper lunge if you're able to, with nice high arms. These movements work your back, arms, shoulders, legs and core muscles. And the last exercise is kick across. If you're standing for this one, you can hold on to something sturdy, like a chair or a kitchen work surface to help you balance. So with a straight back, raise your right leg a few inches off the floor, keeping it as straight as you can, and just kick that leg across the front of the other. Bring your foot back to the floor and switch to the left leg, just kicking across and alternating your legs. Keep going with this for a few more times. Only move within your capabilities and make smaller movements if you need to. If you're comfortable and want to work a bit harder, you can kick a bit higher. As well as helping your balance, this is great for your legs and buttocks. So that's it for the exercises. Well done! We're just going to finish with a quick shake to cool down. So raise both arms up above your head towards the ceiling and just briefly wave your hands and arms in the air. Then lift one leg slightly from the floor if you can. Shake it out in the air for a second or two. Raise the other leg and shake that one out too. Or you can just shake your upper body instead. So that's the end of the session. Great work, everyone. We hope you enjoyed it. Doing 10 today just 3 times a week can have positive benefits for your physical health and improve your well-being too. It's short, it's fun, and you'll simply feel better, so do keep going. You can also watch videos of all the sessions at 10today.co.uk.
TNF Soundings.
Now, of course, looking at it in global terms, every week something happens somewhere. Well, this week, looking back in history, was full of all sorts of different events. On the 15th of May 1943, the RAF's 617 Squadron began the famous Dam Busters raid, using those amazing bouncing bombs. In the same year, on the same day, the SS ordered the burning of the Warsaw Ghetto, which resulted in the death of 13,000 Jews. On the 16th of May, back in 1969, the spaceship Venera 5 landed on Venus, returning data about that planet's atmosphere. And on the same day, in 2019, the Global Drug Survey reported that British people get drunk more often than any other nation. Now, hold your breath for this. Apparently, 51 times a year. I don't understand that, but there we are, that's what it says. On the 17th of May in 1824, the diaries of Lord Byron were burnt by six of his friends, and this was later called the greatest crime in literary history. On the same date, the 17th of May in 1984, Prince Charles called the proposed addition to the National Gallery in London a monstrous carbuncle on the face of a much-loved and elegant friend. On the 18th of May 1952, Professor W.F. Libby reported that Stonehenge dates right back to 1848 BC. In 1969, Apollo 10 was launched from Kennedy Space Center and later transmitted the first color pictures of Earth from space. In 1980, Mount St. Helens erupted in Washington State, causing the largest landslide in history. And on the 18th of May in 2018, at Santa Fe High School, a 17-year-old boy killed 8 students and 2 teachers. On the 19th of May in 1536, Anne Boleyn, the second wife of Henry VIII, was beheaded at the Tower of London on charges of adultery, incest and treason. In 2018, Prince Harry and Meghan Markle married at Windsor Castle. And in 2020, it was reported that greenhouse gas emissions dropped by 17% worldwide in April 2020 when the world was in lockdown. I think there's a lesson there for all of us. On the 20th of May 1927, Charles Lindbergh took off from New York in the plane Spirit of St. Louis to cross the Atlantic, the first non-stop flight. And in 1932, Amelia Earhart left Newfoundland to become the first woman to fly solo and non-stop across the Atlantic. Then, on the 20th of May in 1990, the Hubble Space Telescope sent its first photographs from space. And now, of course, there's another telescope out there looking even further back in time. It's all a bit beyond my comprehension. On the 21st of May 1917, the Imperial War Graves Commission was established. Its function was and is to mark, record and maintain the graves of military service members who died in the two world wars. And on the 21st of May 2007, the last surviving tea clipper, the Cutty's Ark, was badly damaged by fire at Greenwich. And of course, each week, thanks to our friends at Stevenage Talking Newspaper who prepare this for us and for other talking newspapers across the country, we look at some well-known people whose birth dates fall in this very week. On the 15th of May in 1981, Zara Tyndall was born. She was not only the British equestrian Olympian and daughter of Anne, Princess Royal, and Captain Mark Phillips, but also, of course, the eldest granddaughter of Queen Elizabeth II. On the 16th of May in 1966, Janet Jackson was born. The American singer is well known for her elaborate stage shows. And sister of Michael Jackson, her biggest hits include That's the Way Love Goes and What Have You Done for Me Lately? Sticking with music, on the 17th of May in 1961, Enya, the Irish singer, songwriter and musician, was born. Now she's known for pioneering modern Celtic and New Age music, and her singles include China Roses and Shepherd Moons. On 18th of May, somebody was born. I have to confess, I've no idea who he is until I read this. In 1788, Bane Hugh Clapperton, he was born. He was a Scottish naval officer and explorer in West and Central Africa, and he extended knowledge of the Fulani Empire in what is now northern Nigeria. On the 19th of May in 1879, American-born British politician Nancy Astor was born. Now, her I do know. She was the first woman to take her seat as a Member of Parliament, serving from 1919 to 1945. On the 20th of May in 1946, another musical person, Cher, was born. This American singer and actress has starred in films that include Masks and Mermaids, and her biggest solo single was Believe, released in 1998. And finally, on the 21st of May, I think the youngest of all we've had today, Tom Daley, the British diver, he was born. At the 2020 Olympics, he won a gold medal in the men's synchronised 10-metre platform with his diving partner, Matty Lee. And I can't remember whether that's where we first saw him, knitting at the poolside. Well, there we are. We're coming to the end of this week's programme. Thanks to a lot of different people for putting it together. Thanks to the Hertfordshire Library Service, where the team of librarians and experts on what to read and what to listen to helped us to get started in the Talking Book series. And here we are, 8 years later, still going. Thanks to Angela, who researched and scripted the radio listings, and to John, who, as ever, recorded it. Thanks to TNF Soundings for the exercise class series, which has just started. This is number one. We'll repeat this first one next week, and then after that, we'll go to the second one, and then so on. Thanks also to the team at Stevenage Talking Newspaper for the events in history and the birthdays feature. And thanks again, of course, to our newsreaders, all of them still working from home and recording in their own houses. Thanks also to the backroom team, that's Fiona, who managed the distribution of this week's programme. And thanks to Mark, who made the copies and then lugged a mailbag full of them down to the post office. But thanks above all to you for listening. If you weren't there, we wouldn't be here. Here next week will be all three, Ian, Steve and myself, because we're letting Bill go away for a holiday. He wasn't very well with COVID and a couple of other problems which he's got over, but it knocks it out of you. So we're making sure he can get some sun and some relaxation. If he has the odd drink or two, I'm sure that'll be nice. Anyway, Steve and Ian and I will be putting next week's programme together. I'm doing the news bit, so I'm afraid you might hear me first, but after that I'll keep quiet and keep out of the way. Until we come back next week, take care. Bye-bye.